snared. And then the complementing ascendancy, extrication out of this material world into back into the world of light. And that theme is very prominent in the Hermetic literature, which is the Gnostic strand within it. All right. Now, the third major institutional manifestation took the was again in the form of a person, and this is Valentinus, who was from Egypt, born in Egypt, but he did his teaching in Rome, and he constituted a school, formed a school, and his school, let's see, he was in the second century too, 135 to 160 was his school. Now, as I say, he was a Christian, and had an enormous following, and came, as I mentioned earlier, within an inch of being elected bishop. Not quite enough following for it to make it into that, but Christianity would, it's interesting to imagine how different it would have been if he had came within a triumph then. I mentioned Kispel, and Joan was working with a publisher when one of Kispel's books came out, a folio volume on the Book of Revelation. So I guess you've not actually met him, but you have worked with his material in that publishing house. And he was at Syracuse University just about 2 weeks ago and gave a lecture in which Valentinus figured very prominently. And as a New Testament, a young man doing his graduate work in patristics, basically, the Church Fathers, why he had to read the Heretics, you know, just to see them in place and come up against the opposition. And he found himself just so attracted to Valentinus. And yet he was, this is wrong, this is wrong. And what he told us in his lecture 2 weeks ago is that he was just too much a part of his discipline and its perspective to allow himself to say it then. But now that he was an old man, why, he was free of all those constraints. And he said, I certainly can say it now, but I now think I really sensed it then, that Valentinus was right. Was right. But he said, I am on the side of the losers, because in the Christian church, the church declared the other way, went the other way on this point. The specific point that he made in Gnostic theory was that darkness originates within the Godhead itself. Now, the Godhead is the kind of ultimate. And it's a very subtle teaching. It all has to do with the origin of evil. Where is it going to come? I mean, where does it come from? Do you have an answer?
No.
Well, now let me just kind of free associate and tell you, I have not read Valentinus in the original, I mean, the first hand. I've just read about him. But I think his theory goes something like this, and I suspect this is one of the things that Kispel felt persuaded towards. The Godhead, in Christendom, this is the ultimate. Must be infinite, right? Because if anything is finite, it is must be bounded by something. And then that something that bounded it would be plus, and there would be something greater, which would be more inclusive, more ultimate. So we begin with the notion that the Godhead must be infinite. Now, I'm going to have about three steps, and if you're not convinced on that first point, the other two won't make any sense. But let me run through them, then you can see. The infinite must include the finite. On pain of its not being infinite, if it did not. Because then you would have the infinite plus the finite, if the finite, because the finite, you know, is real. We know that. There's no way of getting around that. You know, here it is. So it's there. So if the infinite did not include the finite, there would be the infinite plus the finite, and that would be bigger than, more inclusive than, the so-called infinite, and the infinite would not be such. So to be the infinite, it must include the finite. Well, another way to put it would be a whole that has parts would be greater than a whole without parts, because it would be the I don't know, does it come out right? The Gnostics are all going to say in the end you can't say it intelligibly because it's paradoxical. So we always have that to fall back on, but we mind reaches out for an answer, so we shouldn't throw in the towel earlier than we must. So the infinite must include the finite, and another way, if we talk about this in value terms, perfection must include imperfection.
Hmm? Reminds me of a wonderful Ram Dass line.
Good, good.
Everything is perfect in the universe, including my dissatisfaction with it.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
I had an experience like that one time in a park. I saw a blackbird land, and I was in certain space, something. It was absolutely perfect, just the smoothest as possible. And then as the bird went on walking, it was limping. And I told myself, it's even limping, that is even more perfect, because it included the imperfection.
Mm-hmm. 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 I can see he would have been very popular in this group.
Pardon?
Valentinus would have been very popular in this group. If it had been up to us, he'd have won.
It seems to me that this is stepping a little bit on the toes of the infinite. In other words, here we sit in our august majesty, being both imperfect and incomplete. I think we'll all acknowledge that.
Yeah.
And still saying or attempting to say what is perfect and what is imperfect. It seems to me as though that is impinging a little bit upon the bounds of propriety from my point of view.
I see. Okay. Well,
no, but I am simply saying that I, since it is the infinite within me, I cannot possibly recognize all of it. Therefore, I remain both inaccurate and incomplete.
Yeah.
And infinite.
That I am contained within that, yes.
Well, I think this is all. I think this is all good Gnosticism, because, as Joan said, and you agreed, you have the spark of the infinite within you, and so you're not totally devoid of it, but you came back and said, but it's so submerged that I can only see a part of it, and they would want to say that too, and therefore, therefore, in the end, as they will say, our words give out, and that's what you are pointing to. And then they would further say that the reason we know this is not that we've figured it out, but then through these messengers and the revelation that has come to us, and all that gives us assurance of the kinds of things that we were saying, supporting Valentinus on this. So both sides are included in this notion. All right. I think we want to come.
Gnosticism with a small g.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, but Myra, you're operating from Gnosticism with a big G.
No, I don't belong to any sect. Therein lies the difference. In other words, I do not subscribe to these various creeds per se that Valentinus or the other ones propounded. So I think I would still be within the realm of the small g.
Okay.
Now, as I
philosophical generality, generality.
Pardon?
I say, was it a creed or a philosophical generality?
Which? In
Valentinus.
It was not a creed, because it never, certainly never made it into the church, but it was a teaching. It was a teaching. Okay. But I think, to just give my perception, or how I see what you were saying there, Joan, you came down again as this morning on this ecstatic knowing, you know, which is very real for you. And this is, if it's ecstatic enough, why, maybe the aspects of limitation are, what should we say, transcended, or not very evident in the ecstasy. Whereas Myron has talked less about the ecstatic knowing, But in terms of the kind of conceptualization, and then we all feel ourselves getting into a lot of problems in that sphere. I don't know. That just occurred to me. Well, the last institutional manifestation of Gnosticism was institutionally far and away the most important, because these others were represented by individuals. Martian, we had individual. Valentinus, an individual and a school that lasted, 30 years or so. And with the Hermetic tradition, why, it's a body of literature, which has been very important, sort of an esoteric strand in the West. But in the case of Mani, we have a religion and, indeed, a world religion. He founded a religion which claimed to be, certainly intended to be, fully on a scale with the Roman Catholic Church, ecumenical, and succeeded an extraordinary extent for 4 or 5 centuries, blanketing the Hellenic world, reaching all the way from the Atlantic to the Indian Ocean, to the confines of China. The Roman legions were enamored of it, often far more than of Christianity. And it did not survive, but in its heyday, it gave Christianity a run for its money, which was immensely impressive. Now, what was it? Well, it came out of a revelation to him. Let me see if I can put my finger on that. I'll just read you his account of it. In the year Ardashir, king of Persia, I grew up and reached maturity. In that particular year, the living Paraclete, now this is the word which is used for the Holy Spirit, when Jesus says, I have many more things to tell you, but you cannot abide them now, but I will send the word Paraclete, their successor. The living Paraclete came down and spoke to me. By the way, this was in 200, let me see if I have dates for him. Well, it was in the 3rd century A.D., so he would have had these words to draw on. Paraclete came down and spoke to me. He revealed to me the hidden mystery that was hidden from the worlds and the generations, the mystery of the depth, on which we are, and the height. He revealed to me the mystery of the light and darkness, the mystery of the conflict and the great war which the darkness stirred up. This is the dualism between good and bad, light and dark, having a Zoroastrian background. He revealed to me how the light turned back the darkness by their interminglings and how in consequence was set up this world. He enlightened me on the mystery of the forming of Adam, the first man. He instructed me on the mystery of the tree of knowledge, of which Adam ate, by which his eyes were made to see, the mysteries of the apostles who were sent into the world to elect the churches. This was revealed to me by the Paraclete, all that has been and that shall be, and all that the eye sees and the ear hears and the thought thinks. Through him I learned to know everything. I saw the all through him, and I became one body and one spirit. So it's a clear case of a distinct revelation through this, in this veil of tears and darkness and ignorance, light must come beyond, and he felt that he had it. Now, it was syncretistic in that he deliberately and consciously sought to amalgamate, or drew from three religions. He was Persian. I forgot to mention that. We've had a Greek, Egyptian, and Persian. So the religion in his land would have been Zoroastrianism, which had this sharp dualism between good and evil, light and darkness. Ahura Mazda, the god of light, and we still have our Mazda lamps. No? Influence of Manichaeanism, and opposed by the spirit of darkness, Angramanu, I think a great name for a demon or a devil, And so all history is the warfare between a cataclysmic, cosmic strife between good and evil, light and darkness. And the phrase in the New Testament, the children of light are wiser in their, no, children of darkness are wiser in their generation than the children of light. All that comes out of this Zoroastrian influence. So he had that. And then to the east was India and Buddhism. He drew a lot from Buddhism, and to the west was Christianity, and he drew a lot from that. And he made no bones about this, because he saw his religion as a kind of drawing together, coming together of three great world religions, which now were harmonized, integrated, synthesized through his revelation into what was going to be the true world religion, and was going to take over the earth. Now, so in scope, he thought big, and he was very effective. He was like a St. Paul in his organizational capacity. In terms of thought, however, he was, I think we'd have to say, not very profound. For example, compared with the Valentinus, you know, how just a few little strands, and we were in the Imperium in terms of these subtle concepts, you know. You can't get more subtle than that issue we were talking about. Mani would not have been very interested. I mean, he would have seen it in black and white, the forces of good and the forces of darkness, and much more at home in mythological symbolism than in the subtleties of concepts. So it wasn't a terribly sophisticated or subtle theology, but maybe for that very reason, it was very accessible to people, which may have accounted for the fact that he founded a religion whereas Valentinus sort of founded at most a school of philosophy. All right. Those then are the four major institutional embodiments of Gnosticism. Yeah.
Are there books available, translations on monotheism?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yes. There are. There are segments of it in the chapter dealing with Manichaeism in Jonas's book, and he gives all the... Oh, this is... the author is Hans Jonas, Jonas, and it's called The Gnostic Religion, Beacon Press paperback. And his bibliography for that chapter would send you right to the important sources. Now, I think before we go on to Christian Gnosticism, we ought to do one more thing about Gnosticism in general, and that is to come back to this key notion of knowledge. Because now that we've had a look at this domain, we can say more precisely what they meant by saving knowledge. And we can factor it out, because really the notion functioned on a number of levels simultaneously. First, it meant, or it was presented in the mode of what we might call mythic knowledge. And this would have stories about the origin of the world, of the human condition in it, and the way of release. I say stories, but also talking about these in very common sense terms. I mean, just as I put them out there, that there was this supreme perfect being, and then somehow in a mysterious way, there were elements that separated off from it, and these degenerated more and more, and the distance widened, and the barriers became more encrusted, that sort of thing. But then there must be this journey back up. All that is pretty much common sense or a mythology. And then second, this kind of mythological point of view, which could be presented in pictures, images, and so on, gets abstracted into a metaphysical. So there would be a metaphysical Gnosticism. And you would have a precise system developing. Now, this notion of how many worlds there are, for example, what is the character of each, and so on, the relationships between them, all these would be spelled out into a sophisticated metaphysics. Valentinus was an example there. A third kind or dimension of knowledge would be the practical knowledge. And this would involve knowledge specifically about the soul, or rather the spirit's future. And including, most importantly, the moment of death and how one should behave then, what one should expect, and the names of the archons that one would encounter along the way. And then the fourth would be a kind of liturgical, one could almost say magical, or technical, esoteric knowledge. Now, this would have to do with rituals that are to be performed in the Gnostic religion. And they would also include what I should have reserved from the previous category, the secret names that gain release and passage when one encounters the archon. All right, so we have the mythic, the metaphysical, the practical, and the esoteric or magical aspects of these knowledge, all of which work together to effect release. But then finally, one has the mystical dimension of knowledge. And here we get into Joan's ecstatic vision. The direct beholding of divine reality. Right within this life. Now, this was not the privilege of everyone, but it was recognized that this was a state that did occur in human beings. And this was a foretaste of the state in which the pneuma or spirit would be when it attained its complete release from body and matter. In this state, the transcendent became immanent. The state could be prepared for, but not controlled. In other words, one could prepare the soil for this kind of knowledge, but one never had it under one's thumb, so to speak, so that one could turn it on or produce it. Rather, it was always held to come through a kind of grace or initiative on the part of God and the light itself. In that way, it involved not altogether a knowing, or one might almost say not so much a knowing as a being known. Those two things would be working together in that state. In this state of kind of ultimate mutuality between the pneuma of man and the pneuma of the divine, it is beyond knowledge in our usual notion of knowing, where there is a subject-object distinction, my knowledge of the book and the book that is out there. No, that distinction collapses. There is the notion, both the notion of knowledge about collapses, and also the notion of knowledge for. This is not instrumental knowledge like knowing the secret names of the archons. Both of those distinctions, knowledge about and knowledge for, collapses. Neither can be applied when the knower's own being merges with the being of that which it knows. The knowing and merging with that object obliterates all other objects, which in that moment vanish and disappear. This is, of course, the experience of the infinite within the finite, and as such, it is inevitably paradoxical. It stands within existence as the end of existence. The end in both meanings of that word. End of existence in the sense that existence is no more, but also the end of existence in that this is the goal of all existence. So it has a negative aspect in the sense of erasing all existence in the plural sense, erasing and negative in that sense, but positive in that it is the fruition and the fulfillment and the meaning of all else that we have experienced. Now, that was the culminating and the climactic meaning of gnosis for the Gnostics. Now, I think we recognize that as the mystical experience in all of its intensity as one encounters this around the globe.
Can I explore something with you?
Please.
In speaking of this experience, one of the aspects is that the subject-object relationship no longer is in effect.
Right.
It disappears. Okay. Well, it seems like the subject-object relationship is it's the same thing. It's the same distinction or differentiation as the concepts of good and evil.
Mm-hmm. So it's beyond good and evil.
Mm-hmm. Right. So in other words, in the divine state, the perceiving mechanism that we view the world and the confusion and the darkness and the light and everything is not in its usual state of operation. So it is beyond the duality. So
right. The
arguments, whatever concepts or arguments that are put forth by this mechanism really don't have any meaning when one is talking about the divine realm.
Right. That's right. Well, you're not talking then, presumably.
Right. For sure. For sure. So in other words, what that implies is that one cannot get there by this kind of examination. Not this kind of examination, but the examination of that mechanism that divides things into this and that. It's the same thing as one of the sutras where it says, make the finest distinction and you set the two worlds infinitely apart.
Sensans, believing in mind. Yes, the hair's breadth distinction in heaven and hell are set apart.
But it reminds me, I was just reading some things from the Brain and Mind Bulletin about the holographic model, and Carl Pribram says maybe the whole world is a hologram, but if it is, who's thinking it's a hologram? Is that what you were saying?
I don't know.
Let me go back to pick up on your point. So we can't get there by way of using our minds in this normal way. I think their way of putting it would be you can prepare the soil, as they said, but you cannot force its coming. And so these are the four other kinds of understanding: mythic, metaphysical, practical, esoteric. Now, those are all knowings, and they bear upon saving. So they are included in saving knowledge. But they are only, as it were, preparing the soil, and they do not, no amount of laboring on those will force number five, the mystical knowing.
So it's a grace.
It is a grace, yeah. That's right.
You can look for it. You can only be open to it. How does it happen, by the way?
Well, you can prepare the soil for the advent of the seed.
It would seem that if one could discover what it is within oneself that causes one to perceive the world as we normally do, and simply stop doing that, that perhaps that would be one way to open the door.
One way? Mm-hmm. See, there, Neil, you were going to say.
No, I just thought it was just a good thing.
Oh, well. That's like the $64,000 question you referred to, the Zen passage, Sen Sangs or Chan passage, and Zazen and Koan training, I would think of as ways a tradition seeks to prepare the soil.
Naturally attend.
Yeah.
It's a very paradoxical process, the mere desire for it seems to prevent it. It's sort of, when in that realm, it's kind of like desireless. I mean, in that state, you don't even, in my experience, is in that state, you don't even desire to stay there. When you come down, you desire to be in it, but when you're in it, you don't, you know, and wanting to get there kind of is against the experience. It's hard to describe that. And trying to seek it somehow prevents it from happening also. And it's very hard for the mind to grasp it. The mind can't live there either. It can't think about it either.
And yet, the beauty of the paradox is, again, just kind of from the field of Buddhism, is that your motivation in just even coming here needs to be examined by you. Thus, in the process of examination, you say, you come here, and I'm just going to switch into a kind of Buddhist paradigm. In order to attain enlightenment, this is one step, for whom, for yourself, why, and this is the typical Buddhist process in checking one's motivation so that you can attain the Bodhisattva path to save all sentient beings from suffering, which is, you know, what your real job is, but you have to do your job at home first. So, although desire to attainment in itself, the desire for attainment in and of itself is a block, you generally can't get there without wanting to get there in the beginning.
That's another
and then the dance one step behind that whole thing is stimulated through the contact with the mystery of death, at least according to the Buddhist teachings that I've had contact with. That the whole field of death becomes the thorn which prods you into this exploration of the transcendence of suffering. Both are true.
Yeah.
That's the beauty of the situation.
Paradoxical. You
know, it's just, and that's why, you know, the Gospels are so intriguing, because they play with a paradox, which is a colonic. You know, it's literally a koan. You read this stuff and your mind goes boop.
Right.
Because the discursive mind can't unlock these keys. You're constantly confronted with these alogical or analogical koans, which just literally blow your mind, which is exactly what is supposed to happen.
Exactly. Yeah. Submission.
But what's beautiful, Barbara, why for me the Gospels are interesting and why the koan is interesting, is that it uses words. Use language as a mean of arresting the process, the process of mind syntax. So again,
but the mandos do too, don't they? In Zen, yeah, right.
I mean, that's the it's like there's the paradox. There's a paradox within the paradox.
Absolutely.
Within the paradox. It just keeps turning you around until you're literally at the still point between the pairs of opposites and the paradox, and there's no more paradox.
Right. What is it? Another way of putting it. You cannot find it by seeking it, but only those who seek it find it.
Did you just come up with that one now, just out of the blue, or is that something that...
Oh, no, that's in the tradition. I forget where it is.
Well, I think we ought to carve that in stone. Yeah. You know. Again, that's like the wall that the coyote dolphin's jumping through.
Yeah.
Yeah. or what Sanskrit would call tri-mind.
Yeah. Since part of the purpose or object of this weekend is to explore